Welcome to Coffee with Catholic Workers, a podcast made by and for Catholic workers. I'm Theo.
And I'm Lydia. We've both been a part of the Catholic Worker for the last decade, and we're excited to bring to you conversations with different Catholic workers around the world.
I'm really excited for today's guest because it's Lydia.
Surprise!
She and I talked about the much-needed work the Emmaus House community has been doing supporting migrants who've been bused north by the governor of Texas. Let's turn to the interview. All right. Well, I am very, very excited for this week's guest, Lydia Wong. Ever since we did the Theo episode, I only thought it would be fair to do a Lydia one. And so Lydia, welcome to Coffee with Catholic Workers. Why don't you tell us, first off, a little bit about your journey to the Catholic Worker?
Thanks, Theo. I know I wasn't letting you pin me down for a while. So my journey to the Catholic Worker came in a little bit of a roundabout way. I'm not Catholic, so I was not familiar with the Catholic Worker, had never heard of the Catholic Worker, had never heard of Dorothy Day. But I had heard of intentional communities, that was like a concept that was very interesting to me. I'd heard about them in college, became very interested in them, and after moving to Chicago for grad school for social work, once I finished school up, I was interested in looking into intentional communities, trying to find people who were interested in that. So while a friend and I were looking at communities, she had been told by a friend of a friend about somebody trying to start a Catholic Worker. And so I did not know what that meant, but started meeting with a group of people sort of exploring the idea of how to start a Catholic Worker. And so when we actually first started, we didn't call ourselves a Catholic Worker. We called ourselves Emmaus House, and we came to the Catholic Worker gatherings. But I had objected to calling ourselves a Catholic Worker because I didn't feel like I had a good grasp of what that meant. I was like, I don't know if I want to be a Catholic Worker. But we sort of were just associated as that anyway. And so eventually it was like, well, sure, I guess we can be a Catholic Worker since everyone views us as one anyway. So I sort of accidentally became, or unintentionally became, a Catholic Worker. And that would have been around in like 2011-ish. I'm really bad with like dates and times, so all of that's always approximate. But we started out with five of us moving in together. We were renting an apartment. We were renting a three-bedroom apartment. None of us were partners or paired up, but we all had two people sleeping permanently in living room spaces on a couch and cot. When we first started, we weren't doing any long-term or even much short-term hospitality initially, because we felt like we needed to really take time to get to know each other and to get to know the neighborhood and to become rooted in where we were. So we were doing a lot of things outside of our actual living space, outside of our actual house, but not a lot of in-house hospitality. Eventually, as we got more space, we started hosting people in one of our living rooms, who mostly people being released from migrant detention. And we were able to provide sort of a stopover space for people on their way to somewhere else. So not as permanent housing, but for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time. We ended up living there, I believe, for about 2 years before being able to purchase the home that we're in now, which is in the same neighborhood, just on the other side of it. So now we still have five people. I'm the only original person left, but we still have five community members here, and now a lot more space to host guests here at Emmaus House.
What do you think was that early draw to community for you? Like, what made you want to try it and then end up living in an apartment with people living in the living room and stuff like that. What was your draw, and how did those early days like live up to the vision, do you think, or did you know what to expect or what you were getting into?
Yeah, so I really appreciated the idea of communal life, of life together. Very much appreciated much of the writing of Shane Claiborne, his community, the Simple Way, the idea of sort of like this is what it means to love your neighbor, and this is what it means to do life together. And that this sort of very plain reading of the Bible actually is what it means to do Christianity in a sense. And so with that piece of it, it was like, wow, community life, caring for one another, living in a way that structures your life to care for each other, just sort of made sense. In the early days, it was, I think all of us who lived in that apartment at that time, all look back at it with great fondness, because we were definitely living on top of each other. Not only were people living in all of the spaces, but even our own rooms were also sort of shared, because I had all of the person's belongings who was in one of the living rooms. She had it all stored in my room because, there wasn't any room in the living room to put anything. So we were definitely living on top of each other. And it was a little bit of a wonky space. Nothing was really quite right. If you sat on one side of the dining room and we had an office chair there, you had to hold yourself against the table because otherwise, if you let go, you'd roll across because the floors were so slanted. Dealt with all kinds of fun events of infestations of things. But I think what we all also found valuable was this is the real lived experience of like what it is to be in the neighborhood. We were renting from a civil rights leader, Clyde Ross, who had done a bunch of work against contract buying back in the day in Chicago. And so here we were able to live in his house that he bought on contract, and able to hear his stories. We happened to have really good timing, and it happened to be during a time when Ta-Nehisi Coates was coming and interviewing him, and so we'd get to like peek out the window and be like, "Oh, they're coming to take pictures of him in the house downstairs." And so there's great value there, both in being able to learn from him and the people he introduced us to, but also recognizing that for us, even though that living situation of being living quite so much on top of each other was temporary, that for many people in the neighborhood, that's not temporary, and that it is for us was this element of significant privilege to be able to eventually move out into a home that we had more space to use than what we knew, than we had more space than what we knew how to use.
I'm wondering, you mentioned you're not from a Catholic background. You'd never even heard of the Catholic Worker, and then you're going and doing this. What did like your did your family have thoughts about this, or your friends? And you've been doing it about a while. Is it the same now?
It's been a minute. My family has always been super supportive. I come from like an evangelical Christian background, and they actually always have been very supportive. My family has come out on several times to the Catholic Worker, and they usually get done a good number of house projects. So sometimes my dad would kind of schedule to come out when there wouldn't be many people in the house to help refinish floors or redo bathrooms. So they've always been very supportive, in part because of also the strong religious background in viewing care for others to be important. We definitely have very significantly different beliefs. They're not so strong or excited on the whole like pacifism front, and definitely different views on other theological points. But I've been very fortunate that they've never been concerned that this is like a phase, or that I should move out or sort of grow up, or have like a more stable traditional life. And so I've always appreciated that quite a bit, because that is, as we know, not the case for everyone.
So tell me what life is looking like there nowadays at Emmaus House. It's my understanding you've been helping migrant folks who haven't really had proper shelter there. Can you tell me about that?
Sure, yeah. Right now, a lot of our focus at the house is actually centered outside of the house at the moment. At the moment, we only have one guest staying with us. We had a very full house. I think we had at 1.5 or 6 guests staying with us. But we had a couple crises, and so as people moved out over the summer, we simply didn't refill the rooms to give ourselves a bit of a time to sort of regroup. So in the meantime, though, Texas has been busing tens of thousands of migrants, primarily Venezuelans, from the southern border to Chicago. So over the past 2 years, there's been, or I guess the past year, I believe there's been 26,000 new arrivals into Chicago. And initially, it had been a slow trickle, and then in May, things sort of exploded, May of this year, to a very large number of buses coming. And so when it was a small trickle, the city was sort of housing people in hotels, being able to move people pretty rapidly from temporary spots into hotels. And in May, things grew very rapidly, and they were not able to respond. And so their response was to have people sleep at police station lobbies. And when I say at police station lobbies, I literally mean like in the lobby of a police station. So in the meantime, while they were sending people there, they weren't actually providing anything for them. So they weren't providing any water, any blankets, any clothing, any food, literally nothing. And so all across the city, these small groups began organizing at each station. So our house sits between two stations, District 11 and District 10. And so we became heavily involved in caring for both of those stations. We had a very, very small group of volunteers. It's primarily us and our extended community on our block, along with a handful of other people. But that's in part because our neighborhood is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Chicago. Consistently, the neighborhood we are in does very poorly in terms of income, and then also in terms of overall crime rates within the city of Chicago. So May, people were living there. We were busing people to our house for showers. We were taking meals over. For breakfast, lunch, and dinner, providing water, shuttling, gallons of water back and forth, doing things like just trying to provide basic clothing for people, trying to arrange for people to be able to have contact with their family through Wi-Fi or phones, getting a mountain of donations. We still have two of our spare bedrooms sort of filled with donations, in addition to many donations in our garage. I'm trying to work on getting rid of them. So gradually the city started building up some of their services, like giving food, which you'd think would be something rather basic, but the city didn't start doing providing lunch for all stations until, I want to say, September. And so that's multiple months. And at that point, there were 2,000 people staying in police stations across the city. So obviously, at that point, when things really started to build up, I believe the max was around 2,600 to 2,800 people in police stations. And so that was far overflowing the lobbies. So at that point, we were sourcing and providing tents and sleeping bags, of having at District 10 near us. At one point, we think we had about 70 to 80 people outside, with an additional 40 people inside. Fortunately, at that point, lunch was being provided, but we were getting really good at making very, very large breakfasts. In, a residential kitchen with one person. I was talking with Maria Berg, who lives down the street and is part of our extended community, about how we've all turned, everyone on the street in our extended community has turned into like one person soup kitchens because we don't have enough volunteers for people to like pair up with people for breakfast. And so it would be one person making breakfast for 100 people. And people made it work. People figured out schedules of when you had to wake up to put in enough egg casseroles to make six or seven of them and then cart them all over. So that made this whole summer pretty intense, because it very much was, if we were not supplying things, people would not eat, people would not drink, people would not have clothing. And then things started to get colder, and then the intensity really started ratcheting up. We had some unseasonably cold weather beginning in October, dipping down into the 30s. And so we, at that point, we had, 70 people outside, multiple families outside, people totally unprepared for the cold. And so just trying to make sure that people had warm clothing, that when it rained, we could come the next day with dry clothing, because everybody is soaked out there. And so that's been pretty much, at least for me, because our worker is a little bit different in that everybody either works like a traditional job or is in school currently, except for me. I primarily was doing this as a full-time job. It was definitely this summer, multiple weeks of 40 or 50 hours a week of both caring for these two stations, but then also I had been transporting donations from richer parts of the city down to south and west sides, which are the much poorer parts. So it's been an adventure for sure. Things have slowed down a little bit. Enough shelters have now opened that everyone is out of police stations. As of, I think it was December 15th or so, everybody finally was out of police stations. But that was a long haul and some cold weather for people to still be living outside.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty wild that they didn't give them food or water or anything like that. And it just, it makes me wonder, is it intentional neglect? Is it incapability from the city? And because like both of those are really bad, especially like I'm thinking just of like living in the realities of climate change and stuff like that. If they can't handle 2,000 meals and water, people needing, what are they going to do if like a tornado or something hits Chicago because of climate change? Like are they just totally incapable here? Do you have thoughts on any of that or just the political situation there on the ground?
It's a political touch point. Lots of political tensions, and so any action or inaction has political ramifications. So that was one piece of it. Huge bureaucratic mess to designate money for anything when it's not already in the city budget. The city was setting up shelters, converting basically big warehouses, and they were doing meals there, but also not providing other much else. So while there were 2,000 people in stations sort of at the peak, there also were another 12,000 people in shelters. And so the city was paying a ridiculously expensive contract for food there. So there is some bureaucracy there. There is some ineptitude. The previous administration transferred things over right early in the year. So there was the current mayor sort of coming into this mess already being set up like this. And then there, there just then is this lack of care. I think it was sort of easy to ignore people. I think there was a reliance on volunteers because honestly, it was cheaper that way, to sort of rely on free labor and rely on sort of the goodwill of people, to take care of people. But yeah, it was not a good look or a hopeful look. And this is coming from a theoretically progressive administration. And I think a lot of people were, it really, I think, maybe showed many people what the Catholic Worker has known for a long time, in that, like, the government is not the answer. That the care that people received in police stations was actually much better than what the government offered in shelters. And in fact, before it got extremely cold, people were often leaving shelters to return to the stations because they felt cared for by the volunteers. They were able to get their needs met and feel safe, even though we were all strongly encouraging people to get into a shelter before the cold hit, because we were very worried about people sort of, freezing to death.
So how were you all able to like muster all of these resources that people need, all the clothes and food and stuff? Did you have a donation base you could call on already to mobilize all that?
Sort of. We did start some GoFundMes. We had a congregation of nuns that donated us a good chunk of money that really helped out for our West Side stations. There was a citywide fundraiser that raised a good amount of money that volunteers could submit receipts for reimbursement. So that helped out significantly. And then our house has already been involved in a lot of food rescue with mutual aid organizations. And so since 2020, we had been helping with West Side Mutual Aid. We actually helped sort of be the co-leads in starting that in 2020 to help do grocery delivery, in particular for people who were immunocompromised or elderly, and couldn't go out during COVID pandemic. But that has continued, and so we still help, along with a network of others, do food delivery within the West Side neighborhoods every Saturday. So we had access to some food through that. Of We have a cold storage, we have a dry goods warehouse, but there's a network of mutual aid organizations within Chicago that saves hundreds of tons of food every year. So we did have some access to that. And then we found that we could tap into the rich white suburbs as long as we had donation points that were in the north side. So I had, in particular, a church set up in Evanston, not even in Chicago, but north of Chicago. And there were weeks when I could take a U-Haul there Tuesday and Thursday and fill it up both days. Just with donations from people in the richer areas of Chicago. And so it would take that and transport that both to our stations on the west side, but then I would also drop off to multiple stations on the south sides, that just couldn't get that kind of donation base on their own.
Yeah, well, I really admire the whole project because, I mean, it sounds like you all are doing a ton of work and it is very Catholic workery in that it's like it's just us and our group of friends just the doing it, you know?
Perhaps unsurprisingly, it's beautiful, and it has also been the most difficult thing to make any decisions. Because much like the Catholic Worker, although this was less poorly defined, perhaps compared to all Catholic worker houses, there's no leader of the collective group across the city because it's all happening sort of autonomously, station by station. And so it was very interesting to try to see outsiders sort of interact with this, to be like, okay, who's in charge? Who's a representative? And there were technically leads for each station, but by leads, it was like, okay, this person agrees to be on the group WhatsApp thread for like across the city communication. And so that was, I think that was sort of both interesting to see, in part because it was sort of all thrown together only by this common tie of helping people at stations. It was this very decentralized network that was perhaps too decentralized, because there wasn't actually any agreed upon way to make decisions of how do we decide to release a statement. How do we decide that like this is going to be the process that we approve of when nobody is quite sure who we is? And like, is it a majority vote? Is it consensus? What is it? And so that's been a very interesting sort of experiment, this idea of like, okay, what does on a very large scale decentralized decision making look like? What does it look like to do decentralized care in a cooperative way? I don't know that we're doing a great job of that in terms of figuring out, we haven't figured out the decision making. It's sort of been working, but it has been an interesting experiment to sort of see this sort of decentralized work happen on such a level of scale, because we're looking at, I believe there's 25 police stations with one that's under construction. And I don't think there's actually a District 13. So we're looking at, 20, what did I just say? 23 different groups caring for their individual station in a decentralized way.
All right, well, you haven't figured that totally out, but what is one thing you definitely figured out? And if I'm starting a mutual aid type project like this, what's your number one tip or trick?
Oh dear. Well, I feel like many Catholic workers probably know this, but just say no to those unsorted bags of random donations. It's not worth it. Flood of donations and unneeded donations has been the most difficult thing. But in terms of mutual aid networks, I think that if we were trying to look at something more sustainable and even having potentially more impact in terms of organizing and advocacy, establishing early on what the common values are, what the common organizing principles or agreed upon processes are, I think that is important. There had been many disagreements of how abolitionists or not abolitionists in terms of police was the group, how much or little did people want to interface with politicians, or with the city, and when the city eventually created their own WhatsApp thread and added all of us, right, of what level of cooperation are people comfortable with? What level of dissent are people comfortable with in publicly making statements against the city if they're hired in city positions? So I think that figuring some of that out early on would have made some of those larger, more impactful decisions easier later on.
You know, it is one thing about the Catholic worker movement is that we don't bother with having to come up with agreed upon values beyond our own community in a certain way for better or for worse sometimes, perhaps.
And it does become an interesting piece of what does it mean to try to, I mean, this was not everyone's intention, obviously, but like, what does it look like to try to create the sort of world that Peter Morin spoke about, but on a large scale when people have other disparate beliefs? If people had enough shared belief to be doing some things together, but definitely did not have identical beliefs. And so there is an interesting piece of, okay, how can we help create this world that Peter Morin thought about, recognizing that even in such a world, we won't all agree on everything, or we won't all have the same frame of reference.
Yeah, and I am a little bit curious how that played out in the work you all have been involved with. You mentioned like abolitionism being like a topic of conversation. I wonder like did you how you all settled on that? I particularly if there are thoughts around it because of the migrant folks who've been staying at police stations and what that if that has been affecting their experience or in it.
There were definitely some volunteers who went into it not so abolitionist and came out of it much more abolitionist, in particular because of their experiences with the police in the stations. I should say most of the time, people had very little interaction with the police, because they weren't doing anything. Right? They were doing nothing for the care of migrants. If on the best officers might text some of us or give us a heads up if a lot of new people arrived. On the worst of it, people would actively harass the people staying there or harass volunteers. Got a nice ticket for giving out donations because they decided all of a sudden, several months into it, that they no longer wanted me to be able to park in front of the station to give out donations and wanted me to make people walk half a block. Half a block is a slight exaggeration. But there's people power tripping. There wasn't ever any real among volunteers, any real sort of final understanding on that or many other decisions, in part because there wasn't an agreed upon decision process. So there was sort of like this, oh, it's sort of by like majority vote, but also not really, because everybody's participation in the citywide leads thread was varied. We had some districts that had almost no participation in that thread, because if their district lead simply didn't feel a need to connect with everybody else, there wasn't really that representation there. And so that's where it got interesting, because it would be like trying to say, okay, well, the Chicago Catholic workers say this, but if St. Francis House here in Chicago never said anything or wasn't coming to any meetings, how could we really say the Chicago Catholic workers think this? And so that was that same sort of piece. Making group statements or group decisions was always difficult. And that never, unfortunately, was resolved. I think in part because that's a lot of work. That sort of decision making and hashing things out takes a lot of time and a lot of trust. And unfortunately, because everyone was so overwhelmed by the current needs, nobody really had time. For that sort of difficult work. Most volunteers have full-time jobs on top of what they were doing. And so many people, were far stretched beyond their emotional capacity or time capacity. And so that was sort of unfortunate that those things weren't able to be worked out. And at the same time, somehow things still got done. It is sort of one of those very dysfunctional, functional organisms.
I'm curious to learn what meal you learned to prepare the best during your months of doing this, and if you have like a secret to what makes it so good.
I'll be honest, I did not do the most meals ever. I did much more of clothing procurement. However, I did get pretty good at making massive amounts of scrambled eggs and large things of rice or very large trays of oatmeal. That would be kind of my go-to. Or in a pinch, I'd be the person who brought really bad breakfast by going to going to the supermarket and getting pan dulce, sweet bread, and just bringing that for breakfast. Not the best option. But you know, it's a lot of people to make breakfast for.
Well, thanks, Lydia, for telling us about everything going on at Emmaus House. Is there anything else exciting we should know about before we wrap today?
You know, I think that has heavily taken up a lot of our time and space here. I think we're excited to look into sort of a new chapter in hospitality. We've got two rooms that are currently open, and we're looking at trying to do some kitchen renovations that are desperately needed. And I think we're hopeful that that will give us some new opportunities and new things to move towards. And so that makes it exciting because it's always fun to dream about big ideas of what to do next.
Are you going to do that kitchen work yourself?
Unfortunately, no. We have enough large things that need to be done that we're going to have to unfortunately pull a permit from the city of Chicago, which limits what I can do. So we're actually just crossing our fingers that the city inspectors won't choose to have a problem with all the other work that I've already done, sans permit.
All right, well, thanks.
Thank you, Theo.
That wraps up another episode of Coffee with Catholic Workers. If you'd like to reach out with us with comments, suggestions, clarification of thought, you can email us at coffeewithcatholicworkers@gmail.com. We want to thank our Catholic Worker audio engineer, Chris, as well as David Hayes for our music and Becky McIntyre for our graphic.
Thanks for joining us again for some clarification of thought. We hope today's conversation and discussion have been enlightening and maybe even that you're encouraged to go out and help build a world where it's easier to be good.